I'm so happy that you're here. I'm your host, Devin Koontzman, toddler parenting coach, life design coach, and founder of Transforming Toddlerhood. I'm on a mission to dispel the myth that toddlerhood is terrible by helping parents discover it's possible to embrace this sensitive developmental period, uncover the magic of toddlerhood, and overcome everyday challenges with more confidence and ease. I empower parents to transform their frustration, fear, and self-doubt into confidence in their parenting so they can be the parents that they envision. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here today and invest in yourself and your family. I am very happy to present Claire Heffron, pediatric occupational therapist and co-founder of the Inspired Treehouse. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Devin. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. And before we begin, can you please tell us a bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. So I am a pediatric occupational therapist, and I've worked for about 12 years in school-based settings. So I work with kids mostly in the preschool age range, but all the way up through high school sometimes. And I also, like you said, am the founder of the Inspired Treehouse, and we are an online resource and blog, and we have tons of ebooks and other resources for supporting parents, therapists, teachers, and anyone else who's looking for information about child development. So we have a lot of different blog posts and free printables and things that are available for free online. And then in 2017, we decided that we wanted to have an office. My partner, Lauren, and I wanted to have a space where we could meet and actually work together, not just virtually. And when we found the place, we knew right away that it was like the perfect fit to do something more. So we decided to open a nonprofit organization called the Treehouse. And that is a place where it's in Bedford, Ohio. It's where families bring their kids for free and low-cost developmental playgroups for kids. So they come in for an hour or an hour and a half, depending on their age, and we do all kinds of development boosting play activities, and it is a really, really fun time. So we love it.
That's so amazing, and it's so wonderful to hear how your business has grown and progressed, and how exciting to have a nonprofit as well.
It is. It's so fun. It's been kind of like bringing our work to life. So all this stuff online, all the writing, it just sort of brings it to life right off the page. And we actually get to implement all these strategies and do all these fun activities with the kids in real time. So it's been really cool.
That is so awesome. And today we're going to talk about transitions and meltdowns. And we know that transitions are a really big part of life. They happen every day, several times a day. And oftentimes they're a point of contention between parents or caregivers and toddlers. And a lot of frustration is created as a result. And I'm curious, what do you feel makes transitions so challenging for adults and toddlers?
Yeah, I think there's so much uncertainty in transition time. So even the most basic things, you know, we're done with breakfast and it's time to get dressed. It seems like such a mundane, small thing. You do it every single day, but there's something about that time in the middle. So you're not in one task or another, but you're between tasks that feels very uncertain for both kids and adults. So as adults, I think we often brace ourselves at these times. So we're expecting the worst behavior, right? We're like, oh, here it comes. It's going to happen. Here's the meltdown. And I think they feel that. I think kids feel that. I think they kind of are bracing themselves too. But I also think that kids have another layer to it where they feel almost blindsided by a transition. So they feel, transitions can feel very abrupt and very unpredictable, and even for some kids, out of control. So a lot of times we see our kids and toddlers so immersed in their play that when we interrupt to shift them to a different task, it can feel very jarring and upsetting. And that results in those negative behaviors that a lot of us are used to seeing in our kids. And that makes sense. I think we see that even as adults. If I'm working on something and I get called away or interrupted, I get cranky. I get annoyed, you know? And then a lot of times we're asking kids to leave a preferred activity. So if they're in the pool, if they're playing with their friends, if they're in the bath and they love the bath, and then we're asking them, oh, hey, now it's time to go to the store, or it's time for bed, or it's time for lunch or running errands, it's a hard time. It's a hard thing to transition their attention away from their preferred activity to a less preferred activity.
Absolutely, especially when they're having fun. And, you know, the work of toddlerhood is play. And so it's very common for toddlers to fill the gaps in the moments with play. And it is really challenging for them to transition away. And I love how you touch on this aspect for children where there's this part of them where they feel like they don't have control. And it's really interesting when we look at life from a toddler's point of view, actually they have very little control over what happens in their lives and when it happens. And we oftentimes forget that as adults, I feel like, because we have so much control over our lives, we actually forget how much control we have.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I think we also have our own day and the functional things that have to get done in our own agenda, right? So like, I got to get to work and I'm late. Those are like the building blocks of the day. A lot of times I have to go to the store, we have no milk. And so we just think like, come on, let's go pick up and go. It should be that easy. And it is not for toddlers. It is not that easy. And it takes a little bit more finessing, I think. So
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, which transitions do you find are the most challenging?
I think for toddlers, anytime they're transitioning away from a child-chosen or child-driven activity, something they've chosen and that they are involved in on their own accord. I also think anytime you're transitioning away from free play to a more structured or routine activity can be really hard. And then I think the most common ones we see day-to-day are bedtime, transition to bedtime, and nap time can be really hard for a lot of kids. We see at the Treehouse, anytime you're leaving a class or school or playgroup kind of setting, that leaving, that transition from I'm playing with my friends and now it's over is also very hard. And then a huge one is transitioning away from screen time. I think that's such a hard one, even for older kids that we see a lot, whether it's a TV show or a tablet or whatever they're doing. And then a big one, and this could probably be its own separate interview because it's more complex with all the attachment stuff going on, but transitioning away from a parent or caregiver. So all of our playgroups at the Treehouse are drop-off playgroups, and that's hard. Dropping off and mom is leaving and now I'm here by myself. Again, there's another layer to that with attachment and you know, that age when kids are kind of figuring out my mom comes back and it's gonna be okay. That's its own, kind of its own complex transition.
Yeah, especially in toddlerhood. That's a really big one in toddlerhood.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, and you know, when we're thinking about the transitions, there are so many different transitions that happen throughout the day. And it's really interesting what you said before about for parents and caregivers, that oftentimes what makes it challenging for parents and caregivers is that it's the logical part of our brains and our own agendas kind of coming in and, you know, being so focused on like the logical, the things that need to happen, that then we kind of forget about the child's point of view when we feel that stress and pressure. I kind of feel like that goes hand in hand, like the more stress and pressure there is, then the less focused we become on the other person in the equation.
For sure. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, what misconceptions do you feel there are around transitions?
I think there are some people who might think, okay, this is my toddler. They're going to do this no matter what. So I'm just going to pick them up and go. When it's time for the store, they're going to have a tantrum. So I'm just going to grab them and throw them in the car. We're going to go. I think sometimes it's our, you know, again, that logical side of our brain saying like, I got to get this stuff done. I'm not dealing with a tantrum. Let's get up and go. And I think the truth is that there really are ways to make those transitions more pleasant and smooth. They might not be 100% of the time, but a lot of the time there are things that we can do to be consistent in those transition times and support our kids, in a healthy way. And then I also think a misconception could be that kids will grow out of these difficult transitions. And I think for the most part, most kids do. With age and development, that transition time can be eased and it might not be as intense. But I know many, many big kids who still struggle with transition from one activity to another. And it may look a little different or a lot different than toddlerhood, but it's still a time in that we can provide a lot of support for our kids who are, you know, I think even adults struggle with transition. So I think it's a good thing to keep in mind throughout the developmental cycle that we're really watching and supporting in a lot of different ways.
Yes. And why do you think that it continues sometimes for certain children? Do you think that it has to do with this, the original misconception or that kind of like attitude of like, oh, let's not worry about it, it'll go away or it'll get better with time?
Yeah, I think some of it is that we think of these difficulty with transitions and meltdowns during transitions as a little kid issue. And I think some of it is really just human nature. I mean, I think that we as adults, you know, I know I am that way. When I'm leaving work and it's time to come home, that's a moment for me. Like, I have to really shift my brain into a different mode. And same when I'm leaving my house and I'm going to work. If it doesn't go the right way, it can be upsetting even for adults. So I think human nature is to seek that stability and security and certainty so that we know what's coming and we know how much longer until it's, you know, the next transition is happening. And I think we're, most of us anyway, are creatures of habit, and we rely on that to feel secure. And so I think it makes good sense that kids of all ages would deal with that kind of struggle during transition times.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my gosh. It's amazing. I think like the older we get, and I don't know, the more life that we've lived, we realize how we really are creatures of habit.
I know I am.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Me as well. And so, you know, I just want to thank you also for talking about the misconception that it's like, well, I have a toddler and they're going to do this regardless. So, you know, I'm just going to pick up my child and go, or kind of like this idea that, you know, no matter what, toddlerhood is difficult. So just kind of plowing forward without stopping to kind of think about, okay, what is my child experiencing here? Because this, I really feel that the misconception that toddlerhood is terrible is what really feeds these ideas of like, oh, you know, it's no matter what, this is going to happen, or it doesn't matter what I do, the outcome's going to be the same. And it actually really undermines our ability to be effective parents and caregivers.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think it takes the control both away from us, and that we assume there's nothing else we can do when there are strategies that we can use, and then taking that control away from the child too. So it's, if we're kind of equipped with the tools that we need, it can make it easier for everybody all the way around. So,
yeah, it's so true. And I'm curious, what do you feel are developmentally appropriate expectations when it comes to transitions for toddlers?
I think we can definitely assume that kids at this age are going to need help. So I think, you know, not to say that a meltdown is going to be inevitable every time there's a transition, but I do think that we can assume that we're going to need to take some time and energy and effort to support our kids during these transition times. It's just something that they're going to need support with. I think that also it's going to be kind of an imprecise science. So I think that there's no one size fits all, like here's the thing that you're going to do and then it's going to solve it, because that really takes personality out of the equation and a lot of different variables, you know, family culture, and there's so much that plays into this. I think that a little bit of trial and error is going to definitely be part of the equation here when it comes to solving and troubleshooting these transition times for kids.
Thanks for saying that, because I do feel like this is another one of those misconceptions that it's like, oh, well, I read this or someone told me that and it's not working, so now there's a problem. Like that assumption that it's like there's one way to overcome the challenge, and if it doesn't work the first time, or it you know, repeatedly doesn't work, by working I mean like have the outcome that we expect in the moment, then it's kind of like, oh, you know, there's something wrong with me, my parenting, there's something wrong with my child. And so it's a common misconception. So thanks for saying that it's an imprecise science, and that there is a lot of trial and error, and personality is a big part of it.
Definitely. I think that's, for me as a therapist, it's the most fun part of my job. I kind of think of my whole job as trial and error and just testing, right? I'm going to see if this works. I have like a general outline of things I can try, and I'm going to try it. And maybe it didn't work first time. Like you said, maybe it'll work the second time. And if repeatedly it doesn't work, then we go on to the next thing. And knowing that that doesn't mean we failed at anything. It doesn't mean the child, certainly doesn't mean the child failed at anything. It just means we're still looking for the answer, looking for the best fit.
Yeah, absolutely. The best fit. That's a really great way to think about it. I love that. And so I'm curious, what are some of the tools that parents and caregivers can use to help ease through the transitions and create more calm?
Yeah, so we have quite a few things that we use in therapy that, as I started using with my kids who need more support, kids with special needs, kids with sensory needs, I really started realizing, like, these aren't just for these kids. These are for everybody. These are perfect strategies to use with any kid at all. And we use them a lot during our play groups. So these are all things that we use really every single day. So if they sound like, oh, I don't know, I couldn't do that, or it's too hard, I'm a firm believer, and I know that it can be done both at home and in a professional setting. So a big one, I think a big concept here is to show kids how much longer is left in the activity that they're doing. So we use a couple different strategies for this. We use visual timers. So I have an app on my phone that I use. There are probably thousands of them out there that kind of visually show kids. And at this age, they're not going to know the time. They're not going to know the numbers, but they may see that the time is running lower. There are even ones, the one that I use has a real rewarding little sound and movement when the timer rings. So it's almost a positive thing. The kids during our play groups, they get excited. They ask me to set it. They can't wait to see what it's going to be. So it makes it really positive. Like, oh, and then that means also the timer went off. We got to see it and we're moving to the next thing. So it's like sort of building the excitement around a transition instead of making it a negative. But also like the basics of a kitchen timer or the timer on your phone works just as well if you don't want to get fancy with it. But timers are a big, big one that we use. And then another one that I use a lot with my own toddler at home is first then language. So this is something where you set up your transitions very consistently using the language of first we're going to do this and then we're going to do this. And it's this, I think there's some certainty there, some security in knowing like it's being presented the same way every single time. I use it a lot for those attachment moments when the little ones don't want to leave mom. I always say, first we're going to play, then mom comes back. And I say it every time the same exact way. And for a lot of kids, that eases the transition. So first then language is a big one. We also use first then visuals. So it's just a very simple printed page and we have little Velcro pictures. So first the game, then lunch, you know, or whatever you're going to put on there. We put pictures to show the kids what's coming next. So I think those are two really good ones that are pretty easy to use that we use every day. I know also a big one that I use with my toddler at home is giving choices. So again, it's kind of going back to that control that we talked about. So we're setting up the transition and setting up choices so that technically they're both going to result in the outcome that you need to happen, right? Like you're going to go to the store. But maybe they choose which shoes they're going to wear. So somewhere in there, you're sprinkling in this little bit of control. Like, hey, we do have to go, but which one? Do you want to wear the blue ones or the red ones? Or, you know, TV is not an option. You know, they want to watch their show and TV is not an option for that time. So you might offer two choices of play activities. We could do cars or trains. So you're setting up the transition in sort of a different way. That works to what you need it to do, but it's also working for the child so that they have a little bit of a stake in the game.
Yeah.
So some of our top ones, I have a lot of them, so I could go on and on. So you tell me how many more we might have time for, but.
Sure. Well, those are some really great ones to start with, and especially setting up the first then language so children know what to expect, and then giving choices and really letting those choices be within a parent and caregiver's boundaries. So knowing that giving that freedom, I like to say freedom within the boundary. So it really respects both the child and the parent or caregiver, creating a win-win moment for them. And one thing that I would love for you to share is, what about with preferred activities? Because we know that transitioning away from preferred activities can be really challenging. So what tools or strategies would you recommend for transitioning away from a preferred activity?
Yeah, so I have a couple things that I use, again, at work and at home. A lot of times I do, instead of the timer, I'll do a certain number of turns. So if we're on the swing and we're not going to leave the swing no matter what, and it's going to, I feel it coming, right? Like I see he's going to get mad. He's going to start crying. I say, okay, you know what? We're going to do 10 more swings and then it's going to be time to go. And it's kind of similar to that visual timer where you're like building the excitement almost. It makes it fun and the child can count along with you. It can be, and you can do that with anything. Three more jumps in the pool and then we're going to go, you know, so you're kind of, making it loud and clear that this is what's going to happen next, but you're doing it and sort of, you're making it playful. You're making it kind of part of what they're doing. I also think, and this is a huge one I use in therapy, I work with a lot of kids with very rigid behaviors. And so I use, sometimes I'll use the toy or object that the preferred toy or object that they're playing with that they really are having a hard time breaking away from as a transition object and transition toy. I do this a lot. And I, for some reason, it is very successful. A lot of kids just seem to like need that little security blanket. Like I'm going to take my train with me to therapy and it's just going to be my thing. I have to hold on to it the whole way. And then we bring it and I say, okay, it's time to put it in the parking spot. And we find a parking garage for it somewhere. And then they're able to break away from it. So bring, if you can find any way for them to bring a little piece of what they're doing with you, that helps sometimes. It's just kind of, I think, showing a little respect for like, hey, I know you really loved what you were doing. And we have to still go and do this other thing. But yeah, let's bring one of them with us. Or, you know, kind of trying to take it along for the road. That really helps.
Yes, I love using transition items, and I always recommend this to parents because it's really great to be able to bridge the gap. I always say that the transition item can bridge the gap between, you know, point A and point B or two different activities. So I really love that. And also thanks for saying playfulness and bringing that element of playfulness in, because I think that, as you said before, when the more tense we start feeling in these moments, that stress is transferred onto the child, they can feel that. And then the more tense they get. So when we can bring a bit of lighthearted and playfulness, it doesn't mean just like throwing all the boundaries, you know, out the door, but just coming from a place of lightheartedness and maybe open-heartedness can really go a long way in these moments.
Definitely. I think kids pick up on that so much. And if they see you as a partner and as a play partner, even better, they're going to be a lot more willing to go with the flow and kind of be, you know, be flexible and willing to move on to the next thing because, hey, you know, my mom or my teacher or whoever, my caregiver is being fun. So whatever's coming next might be a good time, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It really helps us gain influence as a leader and guide, because when we can really connect on that level. So I think that that playfulness and lightheartedness really creates a lot of connection. And that's where we really gain the influence where then kids naturally want to follow our lead and where we're going.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's right on. Yeah.
And let's just talk about one other transition quickly. I'd like to talk about screen time. So I know that there are a lot of parents and caregivers in our audience that really face this challenging transition on a regular basis. And so I'm curious, what advice do you have for parents around that transition?
Yeah, I do. I use a lot of the strategies that we've talked about already. But I also, a couple things, I like to make screen time a part of a routine. And I think we'll get to this a little bit later in our interview, but I'm a firm believer in a routine and a structure. And I think that when screen time is part of that, a predictable part of the routine, it makes the transition away from it a lot easier. And setting up that routine so that the transition away from screen time is to a more preferred activity, a positive activity, instead of something that they don't want to do, is sort of a natural way to ease that. Like, okay, well now it's time, you know, outside time or park time, whatever is part of your routine. I think for anything, you can kind of naturally sprinkle the day with those preferred and non-preferred activities to your benefit. So like knowing this is going to be hard, but once we're done, let's, you know, plant something that's going to be a positive thing to look forward to. I think that can really help. And then this seems very basic, but it's something that I do a lot of is verbal reminders. So no matter what strategy I'm using, the timer or the countdown strategy or anything, I am constantly referring to it in my language. So when I read books to my three-year-old at the end of the day, he wants to keep going and going. I mean, he will read books all night. So I always say, it's this book, then the next book, then we're, it's again, that first then language. And I say it to the point where if somebody were listening, they would probably be like, oh my gosh, stop. It's too much. But I notice him and my kids at work, I notice that they really hook into that language and it becomes a script for them so that they kind of speak it along with me and he'll do it. He'll say, it's this book and then bed, next book, then bed. So it's kind of a reassuring way to reinforce the strategy that you're using. So, hey, when the time, just reminder, when the timer goes off, that means it's time for bath. And I say it over and over and over. So it's kind of like you're adding another layer to the strategy that you're already using by bringing the kids' attention back to it. So I do that with going back to screen time. I do that a lot too. Hey, when you hear the timer, that means it's time to shut it down. And I find that to be successful for a lot of kids.
Yes, I use this strategy a lot with a lot of different things, especially reading books. And what I really notice with kids and what I always say to parents and caregivers is that if you sound like a broken record, like if you're tired of hearing your own voice when it comes to these types of reminders and setting up the structure, then you're doing it, you know, then you're really like being effective, because it's really, toddlers need to hear it again and again to really internalize it. And so I call it being the broken record.
Yes, I agree. And I think some people might misread it or interpret it as that you're nagging or something, but I think there's a tone and a way to do it that is actually very positive and very reassuring. And I really do, I hear my kids both at home and at work saying it. Like, it's sort of like they're saying it to themselves. They're reassuring themselves with that language. And so I know it's not a negative. I know it's something that's helping them.
Exactly. Because it creates that reassurance, and that reassurance really allows kids to have that understanding. And also I almost feel like have a bit of a sense of control because they know what's going to happen next, and it helps them feel like they can participate in it when they can predict what's going to happen.
Agreed. I think that's right on. Yeah.
So, well, you know, sometimes through these transitions, we end up experiencing a meltdown. So, you know, sometimes the transition, it's really hard, and a toddler will have a meltdown or a tantrum. And from your point of view, what's happening inside a toddler in these moments?
Yeah, I think kids, again, going back to the transitions, I think anytime a child is having a meltdown, they're feeling, like we said, that loss of control. So the loss of predictability, stability, certainty. And for some kids, a lot of the kids in my therapy practice who might have sensory needs or other needs going on, as so many kids do, it can even really escalate into almost a fight or flight response. And so it's so extreme that the child really does feel like they're being threatened in some way, and that they're not safe, or that they're out of control, whether that, you know, is the case or not. And so I think inside for these kids, it's not just a game. It's not just a, I'm putting on a drama show to make a scene. It's a real physical response. It's a real sensory response, and it's definitely very real to them. And I think that's so important to keep in our minds, because to us, it's very frustrating, right? When you're dealing with that all day, every day, it's hard, it's challenging, it's annoying, and you just wanna get done what you need to get done. And it's hard to kind of bring our minds back to that it's a very real experience for the kids who are going through it.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be so frustrating, I think, because for adults, these meltdowns, they really stop the agenda. And so when our own agenda is stopped or threatened, it can bring up a lot of frustration, because life is busy, and oftentimes we're trying to accomplish way more things in a day than are actually possible. And so I think that this is really what drives that frustration. And so really looking at it from the child's perspective, and this is why when we understand toddlerhood as a sensitive developmental period, and toddlers do have really deep feelings and emotions, and instead of just chalking up their behaviors to, oh, it's just terrible twos, or, oh, they're just being a three-nager. So when we actually look at, give weight to their feelings and emotions and their behavior, that's when I feel like the magic happens.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that's so important. It's sort of, again, honoring both sides of the equation. We have our agenda. We want to do what we want to do. And when we're interrupted and our transitions don't go right, we get as frustrated as the kids do. And what they're experiencing is so real too, that it makes sense that those would be explosions when they're not handled with some care and some planning and some tools and strategies. So
yeah, exactly. And I think that's what's also hard about it, is that when our transitions are interrupted and when we're feeling frustrated, we're not really in the logical part of our brain. So then sometimes it's hard to see, oh, my toddler's actually experiencing the same thing as myself right now. But actually, when we're not in our logical brain and we're in our own stress response, it can just look like their behavior is such an obstacle to overcome.
Yes, definitely. Exactly.
So I'm curious, what do you feel is the key to transforming these meltdowns?
I think another part of meltdowns is communication too. So when kids, young kids or even older kids that we see with tantrums don't have the language that they need to communicate with us, they're going to find a way. They're going to show us somehow how they're feeling. And if they can't tell us, they're going to show it. And sometimes it's through those negative behaviors. And so for me, a big key is giving kids the words that they need during those meltdowns. So whether they actually aren't speaking yet and don't have the words, or they're in that stress response and they don't have the words at that moment, I really like to give them that script. So you seem really mad, and you're mad because, and even a lot of times I'll stop myself. I won't give them the whole script. I'll say, you're mad because, and then I'll stop and let them fill in the blank, so that then they're kind of a part of that expression. They're able to put it out there using words, and it kind of calms down that meltdown. You're mad because you wanted that train, and they'll fill in the blank, that train, that show, that lunch, whatever it is. So I think, responding in a way that provides support and guidance and communication, and I know it's not always easy, but to actually taking the time and effort and energy, even when you don't feel like it, and getting down to the child's level and just really pulling over from your agenda and taking that time, while it might seem like a huge pain or a huge hurdle in the moment, you're really making things so much easier for yourself in the long run. And you're probably decreasing the length and intensity of that meltdown in the moment by a lot. So it's like, if you can just get yourself there to say, okay, I'm going to commit to pulling over, stopping, and giving my attention and energy to this transition or this meltdown, you're really going to have an easier time in the long run.
Yeah, you're so right, because 90% of a child's neural pathways and connections are formed by the age of 5, and that's why I consider toddlerhood such a sensitive developmental period. So when we take the time to really put our agenda to the side and focus on helping children through these challenging moments and getting back to a state of regulation during these meltdowns, that's really what sets children up for success in the long run, and also sets the parent-child relationship up for success, because it really sets the foundation for how children process their feelings and emotions, and also the emotional safety and trust for the long run.
Yes, I think that's so true. I think that just builds rapport in all ways, no matter whether you're dealing with your own child or in a professional setting, you're dealing, working with a child, even like nieces and nephews, or any children that you come in contact with. It's a feedback loop. So the more positivity and time and effort and energy you're pouring in, the more you're getting back, and the more understanding I think kids can express.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I love how you said that you set up the script, but then let children finish it. And that's what's so cool about using this like repetitive or consistent language. And so when children are on the younger end of the toddler spectrum, oftentimes we may have to finish the sentence for them. And sometimes it is a little bit of a guess of like, you know, why they're upset or they're mad. But what's so cool is that then they get used to that. So once they are verbally able to, they know they're used to this rhythm of what happens in these moments, and then they're able to communicate how they're actually feeling. And so we're able to give them the space to kind of fill in the blank and express what they're feeling with their words. I love that.
It becomes sort of a natural, just sort of their natural rhythm. Like when they're feeling mad, then they already naturally have this fallback that they can go to.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, during these meltdowns and tantrums, children are really in a state of dysregulation. And I'm curious, what role do you feel that consistency and structure play in helping kids have regulation for their behavior and their emotions to get back to that regulated state?
Yeah, I'm a huge, huge believer. I think we kind of already touched on this, but in structure and routine and consistency. And I think I say that and people think, oh man, that means I have to have every detail planned down to the minute, and it has to be boring, and it has to be, you know, just sort of so rigid. And I think really that's not how I live at home or at work at all. It's just sort of a loose outline of a routine that helps get through the day. So I think having the consistent little landmarks throughout the day that the child can rely on is so important. And it just really is the basics. Like, okay, maybe the same thing happens when they wake up in the morning. Maybe the same thing, you know, this breakfast kind of looks around the same. It doesn't have to be the same meal, but maybe they eat in the same place and around the same time. And that's as simple as that. Maybe, you know, nap time, there's a consistent book or song or some way to signal like this is happening and it's the same every single day. And same for, you know, dinner time and bedtime. So it's like these little pinpoints throughout the day that the child knows. It's like a little trigger, like this is coming at this time, the same way or a similar way, and I can always rely on it. And I think that's provides such a sense of security. I know it does, again, for me as an adult, I have those things that, okay, when it's this time of day, I know I can rely on my cup of coffee or whatever it is. And it kind of feels like a little more easy, something I can count on. And I think that that definitely can play a part in the overall picture of the child that we see. And if we have those consistent little landmarks throughout the day, we might see fewer meltdowns. We may see less intense meltdowns because we know there's a little structure that we can always go back to.
Yes. I love it. I love the idea of having these little landmarks throughout the day. And I always like to use this word rhythm. And I find that it kind of releases that the idea of like the pressure from like, you know, structure. And so I always use the word this rhythm. So just like this general rhythm throughout the day. And I agree that it is just so so helpful. And, you know, on your blog, you talk about using reset activities after a tantrum or a meltdown. And I'm curious, what are reset activities and how do they promote self-regulation?
Sure. So this is actually a strategy that I kind of picked up from working with teachers who work with kids with more significant emotional dysregulation and disabilities. And I just thought it was such a cool strategy and really started working it into my practice. And then it kind of became another thing where I was like, oh, this isn't just for kids with special needs. This is for everybody. Everybody can use this. And so basically what a reset activity is something as kind of a calming, repetitive motor experience or activity that a child can do. Very simple, almost bland. It's not a really fun toy or something that's lights up and makes sounds. It's sort of a calming, sort of mundane looking activity, really. And what we use them for is after a child is having a meltdown, has had a meltdown, or when they're kind of coming out of their meltdown and they're ready to start thinking about the transition back into the task or activity, we use these activities as a way for them to sort of signal, like, I'm ready to return to what I was doing. And a lot of times what we use are very basic, what we call put-in tasks. And I'm not sure whether that's like a common term or not. But it's as basic as your cream cheese container with a slit cut in the top and some poker chips or some kind of object that they can put in through the slit, a button. And again, we kind of gauge these based on age level. If it's, if it's a younger child, we would make them bigger objects. It could be blocks that they're putting into a container. And what we see, and I don't have research behind this other than anecdotally what I use in my practice and at home, we just see a real calming response to these repetitive activities, to the point where we've even taken these put-in tasks and we've expanded the use of them across different settings. So we may use them as a little trigger for a transition. Hey, we're gonna finish this activity and then we'll know it's time to move on to the next thing. We use them a lot for wait times. When we're setting up an activity at the treehouse during a play group, we'll set out a bunch of things where kids have to, almost like a shape sorter, kids have to put blocks into a hole the right way. Straw pieces, they have to put them in through the top of a container. And every single child, especially these toddlers, are so drawn to these activities, and it's such a calming, it's a reset. That's the only way that I can describe it. It's a reset. It's a moment for them to kind of pull over, engage with something, and then move on to the next thing.
That is so awesome. I really love this, and I can see how this repetitive activity can be really calming, especially because these activities that you're describing really require focus and attention. And so it really kind of draws in their focus and attention to one thing. And I think that this is probably a really large part of what creates this reset.
Yeah, that makes good sense. And I think I don't think I explained very well to steer away. We steer these away from really rewarding, light up toy, things that are really fun in the case when we're using them as meltdown or tantrum resets, because we don't want it to be a reinforcer. So we don't want it to be like, well, every time we have a tantrum, we get to play with a fun toy. So we kind of keep them basic. But again, because they're usually kind of novel materials, kids seem to be drawn to them and they seem to enjoy them and like them. But again, it's not like, they're getting screen time as a reward because they just had a meltdown. We want to make sure it's something that they're kind of, it's just calming. It's just a reset button.
Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. And it's, what's really cool is it sounds like a lot of these activities can just be made with things that we may already have lying around the house. And that also just goes to show like how novel some of the items can be that we just have here at home around the house, and that how children really have a lot of creativity, and can see ordinary objects as something interesting and have an idea of something to do with them.
Definitely. And yeah, it doesn't need to be rocket science, right? We don't need to get on Pinterest and find the latest and greatest thing. It can be really like, sometimes it's just a plastic jar, like, what your pretzels come in, and blocks, and they're just literally putting them in. And it's this kind of, efficacy, this feeling of like, oh, I did something, I cleaned something up, and now they're all in here. It's just sort of its own reward, and it's very simple.
Yeah, feeling capable is so important to toddlers. So I can see how that can make them really just feel so proud of themselves, and really also help develop their confidence. So I'm curious, meltdowns and tantrums, they happen. There's not really a way to stop them. And because I always talk to parents that it's not that we want to like stop tantrums and meltdowns, because they're actually a normal part of toddler development. It's how toddlers express themselves and release emotions. However, it is possible to reduce the frequency and intensity. And I'm curious, what do you recommend in terms of preventing meltdowns in the first place?
Yeah. I think again, going back to that structure and routine is a big one. So having those land, I love how you said a rhythm, like having just sort of a consistent rhythm to your day so that the child knows what to expect goes a long way toward decreasing that. For at least my kids, most kids, I would say, I think sleep is a huge one. And I know sleep isn't probably, I'm sure, its own separate interview, and that it doesn't come easily for all kids, certainly. But I definitely think that plays a big part. You're going to see more intense and more frequent tantrums with a kiddo who's not had enough sleep. I think that also knowing your child's personality and honoring it, even if it's different from your own or different from siblings or different from friends or cousins or whatever, is huge. I think that when you see that you have a child who is more sensitive, needs more sleep, just needs that structure more than others. And I know within my own household, my kids are all the way across the board on this. But I know which one. There's one in particular in my house who needs more. He just needs more attention. He's not a sleepover kid. He's not a stay up late kid. And I think just knowing it and honoring it, and he's older now, but even as a young child, I really tried to give him the power behind that to say, you know, you're different. You're like me. You're different in that you might need something different than your friends. So while everybody else might be doing this, we have to make the right choices for ourselves. We have to keep ourselves healthy, our minds healthy, our bodies healthy. And that might look different for you than everybody else. And that's okay. And I think that can be really challenging, especially when we have families, you know, other family members who can go and go and go, cousins who can go and go and go, friends who can go. And then we have other kids who just need a little different approach, and they may need to pull back and have some quiet time or nap time or whatever it is. But I think it's hugely important. And I think we see negative behaviors in those kids who don't get what they need in those areas and those aspects.
Yes. Remembering that each child is a unique individual, just like we are all unique individuals. And so just honoring their uniqueness and getting to know exactly what their needs are, and remembering that just because your child's needs are unique and not the same as maybe a sibling or a cousin or the neighbor's child, that they're all okay, and that honoring that is really what starts creating that magic and that connection and that ease.
Definitely. And I think having the confidence to do that is very hard as a parent. I know, like, people will question, do you really need, he's fine. You know, he can keep going. You know, he doesn't need a nap. He's fine. And when you know, as a parent or caregiver, like, something's not right, to trust that and to have the confidence to say, no, this is the way it is. And this is what, I know my kid, and I know what the right thing. And that can be a big challenge, especially for new parents, who might not have that confidence.
Yeah, exactly. And what I'm hearing is that trusting your own instinct is a great way to start building that confidence.
Yes, so much. I agree. Yeah.
And I'm curious, what is one action step that parents and caregivers just starting on this journey can take to encourage self-regulation in their toddler?
Yeah, I would suggest narrowing the focus. So I think it can be so overwhelming looking at the full day and thinking like, oh my gosh, these transitions or these meltdowns, there's so many, and I've got to get a handle on these meltdowns. I think it can be too broad. A lot of times I just suggest finding one difficult transition time. And usually if you talk to families, there's usually one consistent thing, or at least one, usually more than one, consistent time of day that you're seeing these meltdowns or these transition difficulties, and to hone in and say, okay, well, that's the one we're going to work on. Let's just start there. And let's just pick one strategy. So you're not heaping on, I talked about a lot of ideas. You're not heaping them all on and seeing which one's going to, it's hard to tell which one worked or didn't work, but picking one time of day, one transition, and one strategy, and just pairing them up for a few days, for a week maybe, and seeing how it all goes and whether you notice a difference. And then not getting frustrated if that one strategy wasn't quite the fit, and being willing to, okay, let's keep going with this time of day that's a challenge, and we're gonna try a different strategy. So boiling it down like that, I think, can be a little less overwhelming than trying to get a handle on all of the behavior problems that we're having or all of the meltdowns that we're having.
Yes, absolutely. That advice is golden. When we really break down things that we want to accomplish or outcomes that we want to see into manageable small steps and just try on one step at a time, then that's really where we start to really build the foundation to where we want to go.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's easier to just tackle one thing at a time, and certainly you know, in my work, that's the way it is too. It's easy to look and think, oh, there's so many skills we need to address here. But if you really just pick it apart and prioritize and find the one thing, it makes it a lot more manageable, a lot easier to tackle.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, unfortunately, our time is coming to a close. And I know that you have a gift that you'd like to offer our audience. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, we're excited to offer a really cool toddler freebie printable pack. And this includes some of our most popular freebies that we've offered at the Inspired Treehouse. One of them includes some sensory-friendly sleep tips. We also are including some bath time activities that support development for young kids. Some tips and ideas for teaching kids how to dress themselves, even the younger kids. There are some things that we can put into place for them to kind of increase independence in that area. And then some activities for that babies and big kids can do together. So if you have siblings that are kind of different age ranges, there are some ideas and inspiration to entertain both. And then finally, some development boosting toys for toddlers too. So that will all come in one printable pack.
That is awesome. And thank you so much for that. It's so generous of you to offer all of those amazing gifts.
You're so welcome. We're excited. We hope it's helpful.
Thank you. And where can our audience go to learn more about you and your work?
Sure. So the website is theinspiredtreehouse.com. That's where you'll find all of our information, all of our blog posts, printables. We offer tons of free content. And there's also a shop page where we offer our ebooks and courses and lots of other content there as well. And if you're in the area in Ohio and interested in checking out The Treehouse, that's our nonprofit. It's at thetreehousebedford.org. And that's where you can find all the information about our playgroups and everything like that associated with the nonprofit.
Well, that's so awesome. And since I am in Ohio, I'm going to come check it out soon.
Good. Yes, we hope so.
And do you have a last piece of advice or words of encouragement to share with us before you go?
I have kind of a little tip. This is a little side tip that I use again at home and at work. A lot of crossover there. You've heard me say that several times, I think, during this interview. But there's something that I use. I do yoga. So yoga and meditation is a big part of my routine and my day. And there's a little aspect of that that I apply when I'm working with a child who's having a meltdown, or my own child, my own toddler at home, and that is my breathing. So my yoga breathing comes into play, and I might look like a crazy person, and I think sometimes the kids even think that I'm crazy, but in those moments where I feel that tension rising, and I feel the stress, and I'm in a hurry, and I'm late for work, and I, you know, all the things are happening, I really try to bring myself back to that, back to slow, deep breathing. And I even really try to match my movements to my breathing. And I really notice that slowing my movements down and slowing my breathing down, when all I really want to do is be abrupt and grab the things and go and, you know, move the kid from here to there, kids respond to it very differently. And if I can really, it's not perfect. I don't do it every single time. And there are times where I really need to work on it. But when I do it, I notice a difference. And I've seen this during our playgroups. If I see a kid who's acting up and it's really causing a problem, or there's a safety concern, if I just ease myself up and slow myself down, I see the child really match that in their behavior as well. So that's just a little side note tip.
Yes. Oh, I love it. That's so helpful. And you know, what I really hear there is like you're modeling that for your child. Not only is it helpful for you and your child, but you're also modeling a skill that they can take on and learn and use in their life as well.
Yes, definitely. I think it's a really helpful strategy. So
yes. Oh, well, thank you so much, Claire, for being here today and sharing all of this knowledge with us. I really appreciate your passion and your commitment. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.